This episode was recorded in the summer of 2024.
Since 2017, the UK has seen 18 terrible terrorist attacks, but the atrocities on our evening news are the tip of the vast iceberg. At the moment, security services are striving to contain a staggering 3,000 jihadists, far-right extremists, and other potential threats. We're in a new age of terror, with self-radicalizing, hard-to-categorize individuals planning violence. But each one caught by the British state tells us something about British society. Welcome to Afterwards. I'm Tahir Hussain, journalist and writer. And joining me today is Lizzie Dearden, author and home affairs and security journalist. Lizzie is a guest lecturer in security reporting at City, University of London, and former home affairs editor of The Independent. She has been covering UK terrorism and extremism in depth since 2017, as well as global terrorism trends and ISIS-inspired attacks around the world. Her book, Plotters, The UK Terrorist Who Failed, paints a disturbing portrait of today's terrorists and unpacks how and why British terror attacks happen and don't. In it, Lizzie takes us beyond the headlines to reveal the diverse lives, motivations and backgrounds of Britain's terrorist plotters, and the impossible challenge facing the police and intelligence agencies trying to stop each and every one of them. Thank you very much, Lizzie, for talking to us. So for some years now, you've been steeped in the shadowy world of extremists of all persuasions and the security services tasked with stopping them. Can you tell me a little bit about what led you to taking such a deep dive into terrorism and counterterrorism?
Yeah, it will sound like a strange thing to say at this stage, but it wasn't the plan. Actually, when I went into journalism initially, I wanted to be a political reporter. But through a stroke of good luck, I ended up starting work as a general reporter at The Independent at the very end of 2013. Of course, a few months later, ISIS declared its caliphate. And it was just one of those moments in history where it was such a big event and everything started unfolding very quickly in terms of foreign intervention, terror attacks inside and outside Iraq and Syria. It became kind of the biggest news story in the world. And so at that time, I was far from unique. I would say most, if not all, journalists working in the UK, and I'm sure many other countries, were kind of looking at and reporting on ISIS. But I just wanted to go deeper. And at the time, I was quite young. And for that reason, I had a bit of an advantage, I guess, on some of my colleagues in terms of the digital platforms that ISIS was using. And I started to try to get an understanding of ISIS more directly through joining its various propaganda platforms, which were moving very fast at that time, and engaging with ISIS members on social media. And from there, I ended up in a kind of strong position to follow what happened with ISIS, but then also take that learning in that particular terrorist group and everything that it did into other areas of terrorism as well.
Do you find, though, that sometimes, I mean, what made you want to, you know, sometimes when you cover these stories, you're like, okay, the story's done, move on to the next one. But what you've done here in this book is actually follow that through. You know, what made you want to learn more? And also, you know, given that far-right extremism is on the rise, you know, why should, for example, we care now about plots that failed?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And I think because I ended up reporting on ISIS for so long, after initially kind of looking mainly online, I ended up being sent to the aftermath of some of the big attacks in Europe to cover those. Mm. And that really brings it home, really. It's a different feeling when you're there in person in a city. I think the last one I did before focusing on the UK was probably the Berlin Christmas market attack.
Yeah.
And that's kind of so shocking. And at the time, it felt still kind of far away. It felt like something that was happening to Europe. And then when the attacks started happening in the UK in 2017, obviously each one is different. Each one is terrible and it affects individual people in many different ways. But I kind of started feeling just a sense of deja vu. It just felt like the same thing happening again and again.
Right.
And to an extent, the perpetrators kind of felt like the same guy again and again. And I kept on getting that feeling, which then got even more intense when I started covering court cases relating to foiled attacks. I started seeing so many links between the kind of people that were committing the attacks, the kind of things they were trying to do, their decision-making, their reasons. And that made me really, rather than just kind of, like you say, as we all do as journalists, do a story, move on.
Yeah.
Actually looking back and saying, okay, what's going on here? This seems to be part of a kind of much wider interconnected picture.
Could you give the audience a gist of the patterns that you saw in these perpetrators?
Yeah, there is definitely a pattern for both plotters and what the security services would call successful attackers, obviously not success in a good way. Essentially, it all starts with some form of grievance, which can be anything from intensely personal, for instance, an issue with someone at work or a falling out with a relative. And often as well as there can be a more kind of meta-sized issue where someone feels like they are at a disadvantage in society because of their religion or their race or some other characteristic that they have. And at that point, you see a kind of fork in the road where people who have these feelings, they start to look for answers as to why.
Right.
Terrorist groups of all different kinds are very good at providing that answer. They're very good at saying, this is going wrong in your life because of this reason. And this is the answer, you know, we are the answer, our worldview is the answer, and we can explain what's going on with you. We can provide you a kind of route out of whatever that thing is, and we can be your path to a kind of much better future. And so the people that you see eventually committing attacks, it's a very long journey. It's not in a straight line, but what happens in the journey towards these attacks is the whole combination of people's life experiences, their unhappiness, often with young men in particular, their just sheer anger, gets transformed into a place where they feel that killing people is something that's both justified and necessary. And also there's a secondary or sometimes even primary attachment to that, which is that they feel that doing an attack will achieve their own ends, make them famous, raise their status, make them some kind of hero. And all of the people doing this, they really want that.
So you talk about luck a lot in your book. I mean, considering how many plots have been foiled, you know, does luck have a large role to play?
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. I wish I had a better word than luck. Sometimes the security services make their own luck, for instance. There are a very large number of plots that have been foiled because online role players, so that's either undercover police officers or undercover MI5 agents, taking on the persona online of, say, an ISIS supporter or a neo-Nazi terrorist, and they lurk in different online spaces and act on it. But actually, on the other end of the scale, we have had some attacks stopped in such incredible ways that you really can't describe it as anything else but pure good fortune.
Right.
There's a trial actually going on at the moment, so this is just at the stage of allegations, but a man turned up at a hospital in Leeds with a complete and viable pressure cooker bomb with the intention of detonating it, and he was ready to do that when a patient who happened to be taking a cigarette break at that exact moment saw him and decided to go over because he thought he seemed quite distressed, and talked him for an hour or so, and the bombing that the man's alleged to have planned didn't happen. And you look at that and you say, well, if he hadn't turned up at that exact time, that patient wouldn't have been taking a cigarette break. If that patient hadn't taken a cigarette break at that time, he wouldn't have gone up to him, even if he was. What made him think to go over? What made it work?
Yeah.
Sometimes things get so close, and the things that stop them appear so random, it really is outside of anyone's kind of planning or control.
Yeah, for sure. It was interesting as well that you said that, you mentioned, for example, angry men and so on. And what I'm getting at here is, you know, where do we feel that things are bleeding into each other? I know, for instance, that you mentioned in the book here that, you know, the Finsbury Mosque attack, which was done by a far-right terrorist, he was certainly influenced by what jihadists were doing. Are we seeing this sort of pattern basically blurring the lines now, or where do you see the evolution of all of this going? Where is it going?
Yeah, definitely. There is a pattern of things becoming blurred, as you say. I was in a terror case, a young neo-Nazi being sentenced for drawing up a plan to attack a synagogue. And when you looked at what he was prosecuted for in terms of the terrorist manuals he had obtained, there was everything in there from Al-Qaeda manuals to even older jihadist manuals. There were ISIS videos, there were anarchist documents. basically the point we've got to is that we're seeing a kind of individualization of terrorism where people are going on that journey semi-alone. Obviously, they're influenced by other people online, but they're not really, with the exception of ISIS, which we'll come on to, they're not really being kind of instructed and controlled right. and steered in their ideological journeys in the way they used to be. And for that reason, people are kind of picking up whatever's useful, and they're not that purist as they used to be years ago. 10 years ago, if someone planned an ISIS attack, you looked at what they were looking at, and it was ISIS, ISIS, ISIS,
yeah.
maybe some Al-Qaeda, maybe some Anwar al-Awlaki videos, the propagandist who was droned after he made a lot of very influential videos for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But really, they were all in their kind of bag.
Yeah.
They're in their kind of jihadist bag, and they knew that that's where they had to stay. Now people don't care. If something appears useful or it appears to be saying what they think, then they don't really care who's saying it or where it's come from.
Mm. Just moving on to certain aspects of the book, really, I mean, it's just, you think this is just absolutely absurd. Could you maybe give our listeners, you know, an absurd case that stuck with you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the people who really inspired this book, just because I was absolutely obsessed with his cases, and I say cases for reasons that will become clear, was a guy called Mohsinath Chowdhury.
Right.
And he attempted an attack. It was in August 2017. And he was arrested when he got a sword out outside Buckingham Palace and started to attack police officers.
That,
luckily,
yeah.
they weren't harmed. They were armed with CS gas, and they managed to contain him in the car and kind of overpower him. But then the story became more and more incredible over time, because it turned out that police outside Buckingham Palace hadn't been his original target. His original target had been soldiers guarding Windsor Castle.
Right.
But when he had put Windsor Castle into his sat-nav, what it had actually thrown back was a pub called the Windsor Castle. And so he was kind of armed, he was ready, he was in the car kind of hyping himself up, playing, you know, jihadist lectures, and then he turns up outside a pub, right?
Right.
So what does he do? No one's quite sure why, but instead of then kind of doubling back and trying to get to the castle, he carried on driving into central London.
Right.
And that's how he ended up at Buckingham Palace in a kind of less planned, very chaotic way, where he was very quickly spotted as suspicious by police and intercepted.
Right.
And I mean, that guy, Mohsinath Chowdhury, it didn't stop, because he went on trial, obviously, for attempting a terror attack, which he denied. He claimed he was attempting something that's known in the US called death by cop. He claimed that he was merely kind of putting on a performance with the aim of being killed by the police because he was depressed. And he was depressed. He was actually a very vulnerable person. And the jury at the time was really thrown by that. And so the first trial didn't reach a verdict. They couldn't make one. The second trial, he actually got found not guilty, which, it's fair to say, caused some panic in the police and security services, because when you get found not guilty, you get released immediately. But of course, they kept an eye on him. And he was back in custody within months for planning yet another attack,
right.
which he had told two new friends, who of course were undercover police officers, all about. And he hadn't even got that far down the line of planning what he would do when he was back in prison again. That time, they did convict him and the whole story was over. But just in one person to see those kind of multiple levels of plans, failed, sat-nav errors, try again, go to prison, you know, that case to me really stood out and will always, I think, stick with me.
I just want to go back now just to the spy chiefs, and because you had a lot of conversations with them. What have you learned about the strategies and challenges that the UK faces in countering terrorism from them? Are there any surprising or lesser known aspects of these efforts?
I think that the message is actually that they were pretty caught out in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back at that time and you look back at what did come into the public domain about the training exercises that were being done, the operations that were put in place, they were all geared towards a kind of organized, networked, Paris 2015
right.
style, what they call marauding attack.
Mm.
Involving multiple people, most likely with guns, and everything was geared towards that scenario.
Right.
What they didn't expect was people with no battlefield experience acting alone or in small groups with no kind of hierarchical infrastructure or links to anyone abroad.
Right.
And looking back now, a lot of people in the services and in counter-terror police are quite candid about how they kind of prepared for the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what followed was a complete transformation of the kind of infrastructure in MI5, for example, the way they sort of consider people threats, the point at which they move in, the way that they sort of divide people up and the way they kind of launch operations. It's all different now because the previous system was very much predicated on a post-9/11, post-7/7
right.
understanding of terrorists being essentially quite organized,
mm-hmm.
doing things like waiting for permission, having meetings. And what had to change since is to move the kind of barrier for intervention right the way back to basically a single person saying something online. And that's been a huge problem. When you look at the stats, they're pretty incredible. I think it's close to 40 attacks, 40 attacks have been stopped since 2017. And in the same time, 18 have been launched. So a case where more than double the amount that have been successful have been stopped. And so we can see in the statistics that they are getting basically better at adjusting to this new reality, being that at the moment, the most likely scenario for a terror attack is it coming from someone who's acting alone,
mm-hmm.
probably not told anyone, probably not acting on anyone's instructions. And although they may be in a kind of broad network, for instance, they may be part of like Telegram groups or chats on other platforms where ideas are discussed, there is now much less room for kind of keeping an eye on people and watching and waiting, because the timeline between deciding to do something, picking up a knife or getting in a car and doing it, is now very, very short.
Just to build on that, I mean, do you think that services are actually equipped now to deal with these current challenges, given, you know, we've seen a resurgence of ISKP in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda? You know, do you think that they are? Do they need more funding in your view, or less funding? You know, where do we sit there?
I don't know if it's a funding issue, because I don't know how big they would have to get to deal with this. But the problem at the moment is actually, and it sounds boring, with resource allocation.
Mm.
And what that means is the security services and counter-terror police have several different what they call missions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually stopping terrorism is just one of them. They're also charged with dealing with state threats.
Right, of course.
And yeah. at the moment, that is on a massive rise. So it's everything from Iran paying criminal proxies to try and assassinate journalists in West London,
yeah.
to cyber attacks, to malicious interference at UK universities.
Yes.
And the kind of portion of the security services work that is being taken up by hostile states is expanding, expanding, expanding. And that's kind of squeezing the work on terrorism at the same time as the terrorism work is actually becoming more complicated. Because just as I said, now basically we're in this very fast, very chaotic lone actor space.
Yeah.
That's actually getting more complicated as well, because now we've seen this resurgence of ISIS and its Khorasan province actually reverting to those kind of slightly old school directed, networked, organized, multi-pronged marauding attacks. And so whereas maybe 3 years ago, yes, the Salisbury attack had happened, it was awful, Russia was obviously on everyone's radar, really so much of the focus was on stopping lone actor terror attacks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now that focus is being challenged by all these other things that they have to do.
Let me just ask you, because I was just thinking about, you explain in the book how the services work. Do you think that the public have been fair to the security service? Do we expect too much from our services, basically, given the things that they have to work on?
Yeah, I've talked to people about that. And I think it was Mark Rowley, who's now obviously the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah.
He had been the head of National Counterterrorism Policing. But I don't think he was saying it as a kind of criticism of the public, but he did say it's a kind of feature of terrorism where I'm working in countering terrorism, that anything less than an 100% success rate is not good enough.
Yeah.
Because people die, and they die in horrible public ways, in ways that advance kind of horrible causes for horrible people. So there is a recognition within policing and the security services that the kind of standards and expectation that gets applied to them is completely different to any other kind of crime or violence,
yeah.
where a lot of people want things to stop. But no one's knocking on the Met Police's door and saying, I want you to stop every single murder in London. I don't want anyone to ever get killed ever again. I don't want anyone to get stabbed. It is unacceptable. Because people realise that there are just some things that are going to happen and there are some things outside of the police's control. I think the difference with this space is that because there is so much kind of tradecraft and statecraft at play, because there is a lot more that's in control, people's expectations are just that much higher. And I don't think that's necessarily unfair. Every time an attack happens, that is an example of it failing, the whole system failing. And I think everyone, both inside and outside, kind of recognises that.
Okay. Let's just work a little bit on an evolving nature of these threats. What do you think are the most critical steps that need to be taken to improve our understanding of the prevention of terrorism? You know, how can British society as a whole contribute to these efforts?
I think that, you know, various agencies need to talk to terrorists a bit more.
Mm.
It's not something that people like doing or like admitting that they're doing, and it can certainly lead to a few bad headlines. But as a country in the UK, we've got a lot better at looking at terrorists as people and not just saying, oh, they're monsters, they're crazy, don't look at why they did it. There's a kind of more a rounder understanding of, okay, they had these vulnerabilities, they had this mental health issue, this went wrong in their life, this happened and this happened. There's a much better understanding of all of the different components that go towards an attack now. But definitely at the point that it gets made public in court, there's a sort of backstop that kind of stops around the time someone started getting interested in terrorism. Not much work, at least not much public work, is being done to look back even further about why they even ended up having that initial grievance that we talked about. You know, why did that person feel that as a Muslim they weren't welcome in British society? Why was this 14-year-old boy growing up with the genuine belief that non-white people were going to replace his entire race in 10 years?
Yeah.
These sound like mad beliefs and very few people hold them, but for obvious reasons, you know, the police and the prosecution are kind of only interested in what they call the offending period. And I think really we need to be looking like much further back and say, okay, how could we stop people even being interested in the first place?
I just want to finish off actually with two issues. One question for you is, groups like National Action are far right, you know, it's been designated as a terror organization, it's been banned. What's your take on that? Should we ban these groups or should we let them proliferate, you know, for intelligence? What can you explain that to our listeners, please?
Yeah, definitely. So banning, legally, it's called proscription in the UK. Entire groups are made illegal, and it's done, or it used to be done, basically for operational reasons, because what it enables the police to do is to arrest people for being members, to stop people sharing material and propaganda and symbols generated by that group. And it creates a whole load of kind of methods by which to hoover up those people and stop them doing whatever they're doing.
Mm.
So in that sense, it can be very useful. And National Action is a good example because it was a neo-Nazi terrorist group. They were planning attacks. There was one plot, for instance, to assassinate an MP. And if it had gone on running, that there may have been more. But within, I think, about 2-3 years, dozens and dozens of members had been prosecuted for various things. And they'd all gone to prison. And the group was completely decimated.
Yeah.
So on that side, you say, oh, well, that's a success. You know, mm. that's great. And then on the other side, what happened as a result of that was people who survived, say, the initial cull said, OK, well, we're going to have to be a bit smarter. So they started splitting into factions under new names because the law is very straightforward. It bans a certain group with a certain name. So if you come back the next day and say, oh, we're not National Action, we're Shmashinal Injection, it actually works, at least for a time. And I think now at least 4 or 5 groups that span out of National Action were eventually themselves banned and eventually stopped. So does banning stop a group existing on paper, but not really?
Mm.
Does it stop people believing what the group thinks? Definitely not. But can it decimate a group's kind of organisational capability? Can it stop its meetings? Can it stop recruitment? Can it disrupt its kind of power to indoctrinate and it kind of induce more people into terrorism. Definitely it can.
Mm.
So I think it's not perfect, but if it's used properly, it can actually be a really useful tool.
Right. The final question, I'm not going to take any more. We finish every show by asking our guest about one source or text, be that a film, a book, or otherwise, that influenced the book that you wrote. What was yours?
The film Four Lions by Chris Morris.
Of course.
Loads of people had said to me, oh, you should watch it, you should watch it, you should watch it. And I knew it was a comedy film. And for a while in my own head, I found that quite problematic just because there was a lot of dark stuff happening. And I just thought, oh, like, you know, I'm having a day off. Do I really want to watch a film about terrorism? Can I laugh at a film about terrorism? Do I want to laugh at a film about terrorism? Yeah. So I put it off and put it off. And then I finally watched it and I was like, this is amazing. And it's ridiculous for anyone who hasn't watched it. You know, it's a story of a British terrorist cell of different personalities who attempt an attack on the London Marathon. It is absolutely ridiculous. It is extremely funny. And it is fiction, but it's also quite accurate.
Absolutely.
And I know it feels really odd to laugh at terrorists, and some people would find that really distasteful, and I can see why. But they want to be seen as serious people. They want to be seen as scary people, don't want to be seen as ridiculous or pitiable or funny people. And so, although it feels kind of counterintuitive in many ways, I think sometimes poking fun at terrorists is, you know, a way of really shining light on their vulnerabilities. They're not people to be looked up to. They're not people to be idolized. And sometimes I think comedy can be really be a way of doing that.
Great. Thank you very much, Lizzie, for talking to us.
Thanks.
Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. Thank you to Lizzie Dearden for taking part in this episode. You can buy a copy of Plotters from the Hearst Publishers website. For more, follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Lizzie at Lizzie Dearden, and me, Tam Hussein, on Twitter or X. And to get news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Tam Hussein. Thank you for listening.